This explanation would consist in the presumption that I myself and the honorable men and citizens of Leipzig, in whose presence several of these cords were sealed, were either common impostors, or were not in possession of our sound senses sufficient to perceive if Mr. Slade himself, before the cords were sealed, had tied them in knots. The discussion, however, of such a hypothesis would no longer belong to the dominion of science, but would fall under the category of social decency. Masses, Zollner, pages 20-21. As a sample of the reckless statements of opponents of spiritualism, it may be mentioned that Mr. Joseph McCabe, who is second only to the American Houdini for wild inaccuracies, speaks of Zollner as an elderly and purblind professor, whereas he died in 1882, in his 48th year, and his experiments with Slade were carried out in 1877-78, when this distinguished scientist was in the vigor of his intellectual life. Spiritualism, A Popular History from 1847, p. 161. So far have opponents pushed their enmity that it has even been stated that Zollner was deranged, and that his death, which occurred some years later, was accompanied with cerebral weakness. An inquiry from Dr. Funk set this matter at rest, though it is unfortunately easy to get libels of this sort into circulation and very difficult to get the contradictions. Here is the document, your letter addressed to the rector of the university, October 20, 1903. Received. The rector of this university was installed here after the death of Zollner, and had no personal acquaintance with him, but information received from Zollner's colleagues states that during his entire studies at the university here, until his death, he was of sound mind, moreover, in the best of health. The cause of his death was a hemorrhage of the brain on the morning of April 25, 1882, while he was at breakfast with his mother, and from which he died shortly after. It is true that Professor Zollner was an ardent believer in spiritualism, and as such was in close relations with Slade. Dr. Karl Butcher, Professor of Statistics and National Economy at the University. The Widow's Mite, p. 276. The tremendous power which occasionally manifests itself when the conditions are favorable was shown once in the presence of Zollner, Weber, and C. Ibner, all three professors of the university. There was a strong wooden screen on one side of the room, a violent crack was suddenly heard as in the discharging of a large battery of Leyden jars. On turning with some alarm in the direction of the sound, the before-mentioned screen fell apart in two pieces. The strong wooden screws, half an inch thick, were torn from above and below, without any visible contact of Slade with the screen. The parts broken were at least 5 feet removed from Slade, who had his back to the screen, but even if he had intended to tear it down by a cleverly devised sideward motion, it would have been necessary to fasten it on the opposite side. As it was, the screen stood quite unattached, and the grain of the wood being parallel to the axis of the cylindrical wooden fastenings, the wrenching asunder could only be accomplished by a force acting longitudinally to the part in question. We were all astonished at this unexpected and violent manifestation of mechanical force, and asked Slade what it all meant, but he only shrugged his shoulders, saying that such phenomena occasionally, though somewhat rarely, occurred in his presence. As he spoke, he placed, while still standing, a piece of slate pencil on the polished surface of the table, laid over it a slate, purchased and just cleaned by myself, and pressed the 5 spread fingers of his right hand on the upper surface of the slate, while his left hand rested on the center of the table. Writing began on the inner surface of the slate, and when Slade turned it up, the following sentence was written in English: "It was not our intention to do harm. Forgive what has happened." We were the more surprised at the production of the writing under these circumstances, for we particularly observed that both Slade's hands remained quite motionless while the writing was going on. Transcendental Physics, p. 34, 35. In his desperate attempt to explain this incident, Mr. McCabe says that no doubt the screen was broken before and fastened together afterwards with thread. There is truly no limit to the credulity of the incredulous. After a very successful series of SA tilde copyright answers in St. Petersburg, Slade returned to London for a few days in 1878, and then proceeded to Australia. An interesting account of his work there is to be found in Mr. James Curtis's book, Rustlings in the Golden City. Then he returned to America. In 1885 he appeared before the Seabird Commission in Philadelphia, and in 1887 again visited England under the name of Dr. Wilson, though it was well known who he was. Presumably his alias was due to a fear that the old proceedings would be renewed. At most of his SA tilde copyright answers, Slade exhibited clairvoyant powers, and materialized hands were a familiar occurrence. In Australia, where psychic conditions are good, he had materializations. Mr. Curtis says that the medium objected to sitting for this form of manifestation, because it left him weak for a time, and because he preferred to give SA tilde copyright answers in the light. He consented, however, to try with Mr. Curtis, who thus describes what took place at Ballarat, in Victoria. Our first test of spirit appearance in the form took place at Leicester's Hotel. I placed the table about 4 or 5 feet from the west wall of the room. Mr. Slade sat at the end of the table furthest from the wall, whilst I took my position on the north side. The gaslight was toned down, not so much but that any object in the room could be clearly seen. Our hands were placed over one another in a single pile. We sat very still about 10 minutes, when I observed something like a little misty cloud between myself and the wall. When my attention was first drawn towards this phenomenon, it was about the size and color of a gentleman's high-crowned, whitish-gray felt hat. This cloud-like appearance rapidly grew and became transformed, when we saw before us a woman or a lady. The being thus fashioned, and all but perfected, rose from the floor on to the top of the table, where I could most distinctly observe the configuration. The arms and hands were elegantly shaped. The forehead, mouth, nose, cheeks, and beautiful brown hair showed harmoniously, each part in concord with the whole. Only the eyes were veiled because they could not be completely materialized. The feet were encased in white satin shoes. The dress glowed in light, and was the most beautiful I ever beheld, the color being bright, sheeny silvery gray, or grayish shining white. The whole figure was graceful, and the drapery perfect. The materialized spirit glided and walked about, causing the table to shake, vibrate, jerk and tilt considerably. I could hear, too, the rustling of the dress as the celestial visitant transiently wended from one position or place to another. The spirit form, within 2 feet of our unmoved hands, still piled up together in a heap, then dissolved, and gradually faded from our vision. The conditions that this beautiful SA tilde copyright answer with the medium's hands held throughout, and within a flight for visibility seem satisfactory, provided we grant the honesty of the witness. As the preface contains the supporting testimony of a responsible Australian government official, who also speaks of Mr. Curtis's initial extremely skeptical state of mind, we may well do so. At the same SA tilde copyright answer quarter of an hour later the figure again appeared. The apparition then floated in the air and alighted on the table, rapidly glided about, and thrice bent her beautiful figure with graceful bows, each bending deliberate and low, the head coming within 6 inches of my face. The dress rustled, as silk rustles, with every movement. The face was partially veiled as before. The visibility then became invisible, slowly disappearing like the former materialization. Other similar SA tilde copyright answers are described. In view of the many elaborate and stringent tests through which he passed successfully, the story of Slade's exposure in America in 1886 is not convincing, but we refer to it for historical reasons, and to show that such incidents are not excluded from our review of the subject. The Boston Herald, February 2, 1886, heads its account, "The celebrated Dr. Slade comes to grief in Weston, West Virginia, writes upon slates which lie upon his knees under the table, and moves tables and chairs with his toes." Observers in an adjoining room, looking through the crevice under the door, saw these feats of agility being performed by the medium, though those present in the room with him were unaware of them. The seams, however, to have been in this as in other cases, occurrences which bore the appearance of fraud, and spiritualists were among those who denounced him. At a subsequent public performance for direct spirit writing in the Justice Hall, Weston, Mr. E. S. Barrett, described as a spiritualist, came forward and explained how Slade's imposture had been detected. Slade, who was asked to speak, appeared dumbfounded, and could only say, according to the report, that if his accusers had been deceived, he had been equally so, for if the deceit had been done by him, it had been without his consciousness. Mr. J. Simmons, Slade's business manager, made a frank statement which seems to point to the operation of ectoplasmic limbs, as years later was proved to be the case with the famous Italian medium, Giuseppe Palladino. He says, "I do not doubt that these gentlemen saw what they assert they did, but I am convinced at the same time that Slade is as innocent of what he is accused of as you, the editor, yourself would have been under similar circumstances. But I know that my explanation would have no weight in a court of justice. I myself saw a hand, which I could have sworn to be that of Slade, if it had been possible for his hand to be in that position. While one of his hands lay upon the table and the other held the slate under the corner of the table, a third hand appeared with a clothes brush, which a moment previously had brushed against me from the knee upwards, in the middle of the opposite edge of the table, which was 42 inches long. Slade and his manager were arrested and released on bail, but no further proceedings seem to have been taken against them." Truesdell, also, in his book, Spiritualism, Bottom Facts, states that he saw Slade effecting the movement of objects with his foot, and he asks his readers to believe that the medium made to him a full confession of how all his manifestations were produced. If Slade ever really did this, it may probably be accounted for by a burst of ill-timed levity on his part in seeking to fool a certain type of investigator by giving him exactly what he was seeking for. To such instances we may apply the judgment of Professor Zollner on the Lancaster incident. The physical facts observed by us in so astonishing a variety in his presence negatived on every reasonable ground the supposition that he in one solitary case had taken refuge in willful imposture. He adds, what was certainly the case in that particular instance, that Slade was the victim of his accusers and his judges' limited knowledge. At the same time, there is ample evidence that Slade degenerated in general character towards the latter part of his life. Promiscuous sittings with a mercenary object, the subsequent exhaustions, and the alcoholic stimulus which affords a temporary relief, all acting upon a most sensitive organization, had a deleterious effect. This weakening of character, with a corresponding loss of health, may have led to a diminution of his psychic powers, and increased the temptation to resort to trickery. Making every allowance for the difficulty of distinguishing what is fraud and what is of crude psychic origin, an unpleasant impression is left upon the mind by the evidence given in the Siebert Commission and by the fact that spiritualists upon the spot should have condemned his action. Human frailty, however, is one thing and psychic power is another. Those who seek evidence for the latter will find ample in those years when the man and his powers were both at their zenith. Slade died in 1905 at a Michigan sanatorium to which he had been sent by the American spiritualists, and the announcement was followed by the customary sort of comment in the London press. The Star, which has an evil tradition in psychic matters, printed a sensational article headed Spook Swindles, giving a garbled account of the Lancaster prosecution at Bow Street. Referring to this, Light says, "Of course, this whole thing is a hash of ignorance, unfairness and prejudice. We do not care to discuss it or to controvert it. It would be useless to do so for the sake of the unfair, the ignorant, and the prejudiced, and it is not necessary for those who know." Suffice it to say that the Star only supplies one more instance of the difficulty of getting all the facts before the public, but the prejudiced newspapers have themselves to blame for their ignorance or inaccuracy. 1886, p. 433. It is the story of the Davenport brothers and Mask line over again. If Slade's career is difficult to appraise, and if one is forced to admit that while there was an overpowering preponderance of psychic results, there was also a residuum which left the unpleasant impression that the medium might supplement truth with fraud, the same admission must be made in the case of the medium Monk, who played a considerable part for some years in the 70s. Of all mediums, none is more difficult to appraise, for on the one hand many of his results are beyond all dispute, while in a few there seems to be an absolute certainty of dishonesty. In his case, as in Slade's, there were physical causes which would account for a degeneration of the moral and psychic powers. Illustration of Francis Ward Monk. Monk was a nonconformist clergyman, a favorite pupil of the famous Spurgeon. According to his own account, he had been subject from childhood to psychic influences, which increased with his growth. In 1873 he announced his adhesion to spiritualism and gave an address in the Cavendish Rooms. Shortly afterwards he began to give demonstrations, which appear to have been unpaid and were given in light. In 1875 he made a tour through England and Scotland, his performances exciting much attention and debate, and in 1876 he visited Ireland, where his powers were directed towards healing. Hence he was usually known as Dr. Monk, a fact which naturally aroused some protest from the medical profession. Dr. Alfred Russel Wallace, a most competent and honest observer, has given an account of a materialization essay tilde copyright hence with Monk which appears to be as critic proof as such a thing could be. No subsequent suspicion or conviction can ever eliminate such an incontrovertible instance of psychic power. It is to be noted how far the effects were in agreement with the subsequent demonstrations of ectoplasmic outflow in the case of Eva and other modern mediums. Dr. Wallace's companions upon this occasion were Mr. Stainton Moses and Mr. Hensley Wedgwood. Dr. Wallace writes, illustration of Alfred Russel Wallace. It was a bright summer afternoon, and everything happened in the full light of day. After a little conversation, Monk, who was dressed in the usual clerical black, appeared to go into a trance, then stood up a few feet in front of us, and after a little while pointed to his side, saying, "Look." We saw there a faint white patch on his coat on the left side. This grew brighter, then seemed to flicker and extend both upwards and downwards, till very gradually it formed a cloudy pillar extending from his shoulder to his feet and close to his body. Dr. Wallace goes on to describe how the cloudy figure finally assumed the form of a thickly draped woman, who, after a brief space, appeared to be absorbed into the body of the medium. He adds, "The whole process of the formation of a shrouded figure was seen in full daylight." Mr. Wedgwood assured him that he had led even more remarkable manifestations of this kind with Monk, when the medium was in a deep trance, and in full view. It is quite impossible after such evidence to doubt the powers of the medium at that time. Archdeacon Kelly, who had seen similar exhibitions, offered a prize of £1,000 to Mr. J. N. Maskline, the famous conjurer, if he could duplicate the performance. This challenge was accepted by Mr. Maskline, but the evidence showed that the imitation bore no relation to the original. He attempted to gain a decision in the courts, but the verdict was against him. It is interesting to compare the account given by Russel Wallace and the experience later of a well-known American, Judge Daly. This gentleman wrote, "Glancing at Dr. Monk's side we observed what looked like an opalescent mass of compact steam emerging from just below his heart on the left side. It increased in volume, rising up and extending downward, the upper portions taking the form of a child's head, the face being distinguished as that of a little child I had lost some 20 years previously. It only remained in this form for a moment, and then suddenly disappeared, seeming to be instantly absorbed into the doctor's side. This remarkable phenomenon was repeated 4 or 5 times, in each instance the materialization being more distinct than the preceding one. This was witnessed by all in the room, with gas burning sufficiently bright for every object in the room to be plainly visible. It was a phenomenon seldom to be seen, and has enabled all who saw it to vouch for, not only the remarkable power possessed by Dr. Monk as a materializing medium, but as to the wonderful manner in which a spirit draws out. Surely it is vain after such testimony to deny that Monk had, indeed, great psychic powers. Apart from materializations, Dr. Monk was a remarkable slate-writing medium. Dr. Russell Wallace, in a letter to The Spectator, says that with Monk at a private house in Richmond he cleaned two slates, and after placing a fragment of pencil between them, tied them together tightly with a strong cord, lengthways and crosswise, in a manner that prevented any movement. I then lay them flat on the table without losing sight of them for an instant. Dr. Monk placed the fingers of both hands on them, while I and a lady sitting opposite placed our hands on the corners of the slates. From this position our hands were never moved till I untied the slates to ascertain the result. Monk asked Wallace to name a word to be written on the slate. He chose the word God, and in answer to a request decided that it should be lengthways on the slate. The sound of writing was heard, and when the medium's hands were withdrawn, Dr. Wallace opened the slates and found on the lower one the word he had asked for and written in the manner requested. Dr. Wallace says, "The essential features of this experiment are that I myself cleaned and tied up the slates, that I kept my hands on them all the time, that they never went out of my sight for a moment, and that I named the word to be written, and the manner of writing it after they were thus secured and held by me." Mr. Edward T. Bennett, Assistant Secretary to the Society for Psychical Research, adds to this account, "I was present on this occasion, and certify that Mr. Wallace's account of what happened is correct." Another good test is described by Mr. W. P. Adshead, of Belper, a well-known investigator, who says of S.A. Tilda copyright dance held in Derby on September 18, 1876, there were 8 persons present, 3 ladies and 5 gentlemen. A lady whom Dr. Monk had never before seen had a slate passed to her by a sitter, which she examined and found clean. The slate pencil which was on the table a few minutes before we sat down could not be found. An investigator suggested that it would be a good test if a lead pencil were used. Accordingly, a lead pencil was put on the slate, and the lady held both under the table. The sound of writing was instantly heard, and in a few seconds a communication had been written filling one side of the slate. The writing was done in lead, and was very small and neat, and alluded to a strictly private matter. Here were 3 tests at once. 1. Writing was obtained without the medium, or any other person but the lady, touching the slate from first to last. 2. It was written with lead pencil at the spontaneous suggestion of another stranger. 3. It gave an important test communication regarding a matter that was strictly private. Dr. Monk did not so much as touch the slate from first to last. Mr. Adshead also speaks of physical phenomena occurring freely with this medium when his hands were closely confined in an apparatus called the stocks, which did not permit movement of even an inch in any direction. In the year 1876 the slate trial was going on in London, as already described, and exposures were in the air. In considering the following rather puzzling and certainly suspicious case, one has to remember that when a man who is a public performer, a conjurer or a mesmerist, can pose as having exposed a medium, he wins a valuable public advertisement and attracts to himself all that very numerous section of the community who desire to see such an exposure. It is only fair to bear this in mind in endeavoring to hold the scales fair where there is a conflict of evidence. In this case the conjurer and mesmerist was one lodge, and the occasion was a S.A. Tilda copyright dance held at Huddersfield on November 3, 1876. Mr. Lodge suddenly demanded that the medium be searched. Monk, whether dreading assault or to save himself exposure, ran upstairs and locked himself in his room. He then let himself down from his window and made for the police office, where he lodged a complaint as to his treatment. The door of his bedroom had been forced and his effects searched, with the result that a pair of stuffed gloves was found. Monk asserted that these gloves had been made for a lecture in which he had exposed the difference between conjuring and mediumship. Still, as a spiritualist paper remarked at the time, the phenomena of his mediumship do not rest on his probity at all. If he were the greatest rogue and the most accomplished conjurer rolled into one, it would not account for the manifestations which have been reported of him. Monk was sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment, and is alleged to have made a confession to Mr. Lodge. After his release from prison, Monk held a number of test sittings with Stainton Moses, at which remarkable phenomena occurred. Like comments, those whose names we have mentioned as testifying to the genuineness of Dr. Monk's mediumship are well known to the older spiritualists as keen and scrupulously cautious experimenters, and Mr. Hensley Wedgwood's name carried much weight, as he was known as a man of science and was brother-in-law of Charles Darwin. There is an element of doubt about the Huddersfield case, as the accuser was by no means an impartial person, but Sir William Barrett's testimony makes it clear that Monk did sometimes descend to deliberate and cold-blooded trickery. Sir William writes, "I caught the doctor in a gross bit of fraud, a piece of white muslin on a wire frame with a black thread attached, being used by the medium to simulate a partially materialized spirit." Such an exposure, coming from so sure a source, arouses a feeling of disgust which urges one to throw the whole evidence concerning the man into the waste paper basket. One must, however, be patient and reasonable in such matters. Monk's earlier essay Tilda Copyright Answers, as has been clearly shown, were in good light, and any such clumsy mechanism was out of the question. We must not argue that because a man once forges, therefore he has never signed an honest check in his life. But we must clearly admit that Monk was capable of fraud, that he would take the easier way when things were difficult, and that each of his manifestations should be carefully checked. 14. A collective investigations of spiritualism. Several committees have at different times sat upon the subject of spiritualism. Of these, the two most important are that of the Dialectical Society in 1869-70, and the Seabutt Commission in 1884, the first British and the second American. To these may be added that of the French Society, Institut General Psychologique in 1905-8. In spite of the intervals between these various investigations, it will be convenient to treat them in a single chapter, as certain remarks in common apply to each of them. There are obvious difficulties in the way of collective investigations, difficulties which are so grave that they are almost insurmountable. When a Crookes or a Lombroso explores the subject, he either sits alone with the medium, or he has with him others whose knowledge of psychic conditions and laws may be helpful in the matter. This is not usually so with these committees. They fail to understand that they are themselves part of the experiment, and that it is possible for them to create such intolerable vibrations, and to surround themselves with so negative an atmosphere, that these outside forces, which are governed by very definite laws, are unable to penetrate it. It is not in vain that the three words with one accord are interpolated into the account of the apostolic sitting in the upper room. If a small piece of metal may upset a whole magnetic installation, so a strong adverse psychic current may ruin a psychic circle. It is for this reason, and not on account of any superior credulity, that practicing spiritualists continually get such results as are never attained by mere researchers. This also may be the reason why the one committee upon which spiritualists were fairly well represented was the one which gained the most positive results. This was the committee which was chosen by the Dialectical Society of London, a committee which began its explorations early in 1869 and presented its report in 1871. If common sense and the ordinary laws of evidence had been followed in the reception of this report, the progress of psychic truth would have been accelerated by 50 years. 34 gentlemen of standing were appointed upon this committee, the terms of reference being to investigate the phenomena alleged to be spiritual manifestations. The majority of the members were certainly in the mood to unmask an imposture, but they encountered a body of evidence which could not be disregarded, and they ended by asserting that the subject is worthy of more serious attention and careful investigation than it has hitherto received. This conclusion so amazed the society which they represented that they could not get it to publish the findings, so the committee in a spirited way published them at their own cost, thus giving permanent record to a most interesting investigation. The members of the committee were drawn from many varied professions and included a Doctor of Divinity, two physicians, two surgeons, two civil engineers, two fellows of scientific societies, two barristers, and others of repute. Charles Bradlaugh the rationalist was a member.